This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Confringe reading series. All right, let's get this show on the road again. I'm told I have to mention chocolate fudge cake and Knickerbocker glory because it might not have got on the recording and during the last bit, but yeah, those of you on the podcast will just have to wonder what that's all about. Also, for the benefit of people on the podcast, our next reader, Gay Seabold, not only has the most amazing green-blue hair, but she has these shoes with little cat faces on. And I am seriously jealous. She may not get out of the pub tonight with those shoes. So, anyway, I'm sure she has some amazing stories for us, so I shall hand over the microphone to her. Gay Seabold.
That was one of those mysterious shops that I've never been able to find again. Very appropriate place to buy fantasy shoes from. Okay, I'm going to do a couple of flash pieces, and the first one is called Little Red Hoodie. Now, don't forget this bag for your Nan. The woman looks into the shopping bag, shudders, and closes it again. Sometimes I wonder what I married into. Red sighs and does an exaggerated adolescent shrug. She'd heard that before. And don't go by the Whitman estate and stay away from that old tramp by the off licence. Mum! I don't want to be phoning the hospitals or the police. I'll be late. The woman looks out the window. Oh, blast. Yes, hurry. Wait, have you got your mobile? Yes, Mum. And yes, it's got credit, and yes, it's switched on. Don't you give me that voice, young lady. If that plumber had turned up when he was supposed to... She rolls her eyes towards the upstairs, where there is an ominous, constant dripping sound. But I have to keep emptying the bucket. Beyond the kitchen window, the moon is rising over the rooftops, fat as a cheese, smoky autumn yellow. Can I just go? You ring me the second you get there. Tell your Nan I said you're to stay overnight, and if she gets out of hand... I know. Anyway, she can't help it. Sometimes I wonder. Just make sure her chain's on. I know what she's like. She grasps the girl's wrist as she's about to leave. Red, be careful, she says. You're old enough. With one final eye-rolling, Mum! Red escapes, swinging the bag with Nan's supplies in one hand, tugging at the neck of her jacket with the other. It's too small, really, but she likes it. She pulls the hood up and pretends she's one of the lads from the estate, all droopy trousers and bravado, and giggles to herself as she walks. She's still mostly a child. She doesn't hurry. She wanders and looks in windows and makes up stories about the people behind them, but her musings are interrupted by the crash of glass, a straggle of drunken laughter. She looks up. The moon's lost its yellow. Suddenly it's a bone-white eye. She starts to walk faster. Red isn't very interested in cars and doesn't notice the sleek black late-model Jag cruising like a shark, even when it comes past her the second time. Slower. The streets are almost empty. The car stops. The window slides down, electrically silent. Excuse me. The voice is smooth. I'm looking for Laburnum Drive. If she'd been watching, she would know the car has already been down Laburnum Drive. It turned out of it just now. She pulls her hood further down. Her voice comes out gruff. I don't know. I've got a map here. Perhaps you could show me? Come on, you can't see it from over there. A pause. I'll give you some money, if you like, for your trouble. She shouldn't get too close. But by the time she realises she shouldn't, it's already too late. Nan's bungalow sits with three others at the far end of the estate, a last decrepit clutch at suburban respectability before the motorway. Her garden's overgrown. In the morning light, Red's mother pushes frantically through the nettles, ignoring the stings. Nan! She hammers on the door. Nan! Eventually, slowly, it opens. The old woman looks out, blinking. Oh, hello, dear. Where is she? Inside. She's... B- but the woman shoves past her into the house and sees Red curled in the old chair, tugging idly at the buckle of a studded dog collar attached to a thick, heavy chain. "What happened? I phoned and phoned. I'm sorry, Mum." There's a streak of darkness on Red's jacket. Her face has changed, suddenly older, as though years happened to her last night. Or centuries. She's remarkably calm. "Honestly," the old woman says, "sending her out on full moon, and her all of 12, you should have known." "Who was it?" Red's mother says. "Some perv," Red says. "Don't worry." "Don't worry? What do you mean, don't worry?" "We disposed of it, dear," says Nan. "I've been dealing with this sort of thing a long time." Nan grins. Her teeth are long and white and sharp. "If you'd been one of us, we'd have saved you a leg." This next one is a slightly different tone. It's called Tempus Fugit. Before he finished the first circuit, Terry's hip was grinding with pain. He'd reached the far corner of the athletic ground, where the bushes grew densely below the railway embankment. Then he heard a sigh, smelled a brief waft of something sweet. Young'uns, smoking dope, probably feeling each other up. Plenty of them around, kicking a ball about, showing off for a girlfriend on the sidelines. Girls playing these days, too. He tried not to be obvious about looking. A pretty arse could still brighten his day, but he didn't fancy being beaten up for it. He wasn't, refused to be, some Daily Mail knee-jerk old fool who thought all the young were villains. But he did get angry at the ones who just seemed to hang around, looking threatening, wasting time that they'd never have again. On the second circuit, he caught the scent again. He slowed, without realising. A throat-catching sweetness that made him think of religion or mystery. He wondered where that had come from. He wasn't even a lapsed Catholic. Wouldn't know what church incense smelled like if he sat on a censer. Sometimes he wished he was religious. It had been a rotten week. An old friend had gone into a nursing home. Terry was working up the courage for a visit, dreading the smell of baby powder over pee and the bemused and whimpering occupants. The third time around, he caught the same scent and a sound, maybe a sob. This time he stopped, pressing his hand to his hip, half glad of the excuse. "Who's there? Who's messing about back there?" Whispers. His spine chilled, but he walked forward into the green darkness, cursing himself for an old fool. There were two of them, a boy and a girl, both inhumanly beautiful, like the Taj Mahal or the moon, gowned for a costume party. "Who?" Terry said. "Hello," said the girl. She had silver bells on her gown and her voice. "Hello," said the boy. A golden voice, summer flowers, glades filled with light. "Who are you?" Terry managed. "We're..." They looked at each other, back at Terry. Their movements had a languid dreaminess. "Visitors," the boy said, "from across the ferny brae." "Tell me, why do you run?" said the girl. "We see you running, but you just go around. Then you go away." "To stay fit," he said absently. The phrase about the ferny brae reminded him of something. He wasn't afraid. They were frail-looking, small, and seemed half asleep. "Fit for what?" said the boy. Terry laughed, abrupt and bitter. "Wish I knew. Trying to hold old age off as long as I can." "You're already old," the girl said. "Yeah, right. I want to stay active is all. Not that it makes any difference. Age is a bastard. You'll find out if you stop smoking, whatever you're smoking, long enough to live past 50. "Smoking?" They looked puzzled. "Why is age a bastard?" said the boy. "It hurts. Everything stops working. If you're lucky, you go out like a light. If not, you end up dribbling your days away, not knowing your own name. Enjoy your youth while you can. You youngsters seem to think it lasts forever, but it doesn't. He realised the girl was crying, tears slipping like silver down her perfect pale skin. "Hey, don't," he said. "You've got years yet." "Yes," said the boy. "We have years. Endless years before us and behind us, and we cannot change. We are as we are, and all that happens is that we thin and fade. We have no children to carry the future, only a past that lies on us like lead, crushing the sunlight, silencing laughter." He got it, finally. "You're... what, fair folk? Fae?" The boy shrugged. "If you will."
"And you don't age?"
"No. And there have been no children for so long." The girl looked out at the field where a young man with dreadlocks was shepherding 8 or 9 small children into a noisy game. Her face showed almost no expression, but her ache echoed in Terry's own chest. "And you can't die." The two of them linked hands. "Only by iron, and it takes more courage than we have," the boy said. He brushed Terry's cheek with a long, cool finger. "You," he said, "you are so beautiful. Do you not know it? It is your briefness makes you so." "You burn so bright and fierce," the girl said. "You blaze." "Ha!" Terry looked down at his hands, rivered with blue veins. "Beautiful, hey? Well, there's a thing. Can you make me young again? Sprinkle me with fairy dust?" "No," said the girl. "We could only make you last longer." "Don't ask," said the boy. "Please."
"Fairy gifts come with a price, don't they?" Terry said.
"Always."
"Well then."
He was never sure how long he spent there, talking, nor sure what was said. Only that he left feeling touched with mystery, feeling winged with joy and drenched with a profound sorrow that was almost sweet. He kept running as long as he could, though he never saw them again. He visited his friend and took an old book of fairy tales and read them aloud while the nurses gathered in the doorway listening. Terry died in the end, swift and clean. Collapsed on his kitchen floor while he made tea. The trains continued to rumble along the embankment, and in the bushes the scent of somewhere else still hung. 2 pairs of eyes watched the playing children grow, and the children after. Eventually the athletic ground was dug up, and boxy houses grew where the bushes had been. One morning the driver of the 8:15 froze in his seat, thinking he'd seen 2 figures on the line, standing with their hands linked. But when the train reached them, they blew away like smoke, and the iron wheels pounded on into the future. And this final one is called Thomas and the Machine. Thomas frowned. There was a smudge on a pipe he was sure he'd already cleaned. He sighed. Once he'd been able to keep up. It seemed that the older he got, the bigger the machine got. This was, of course, true. When he first began to work on it, it only covered 1 wall of this underground room. At least, so he thought. He stretched to ease his aching back and looked around. The machine now covered 3 of the walls. A great intricate mass of pipes, joints, valves and dials. It crept up into the echoing darkness of the roof. The ladder Thomas used to clean the upper reaches stood, in narrowing's perspective, ready for use. When had he got the ladder? Who'd bought it? Thomas shrugged. The same people who left his food and his clothes. It wasn't his concern. He could see no more smudges, so he could go to bed now. "Respect the machine," he said, and went to the bathroom cubicle. He always shut the door, even though there had been no one else there for as long as he could remember. To do otherwise would be disrespectful. He folded himself neatly onto the bed in the corner of the room. The machine hissed and creaked, thudded and roared. It had grown louder at the same pace as it had grown larger, so Thomas barely noticed, and usually slept easily amid the cacophony. Tonight, though, he found thoughts chasing themselves around his mind. He was getting stiff in the joints. At the end of a busy day, the small of his back had started to develop a hot, low ache. How long would he be able to keep up with his duties? And what happened when he couldn't? He knew, of course, what should happen. The machine would take care of him as he took care of it. But sometimes other treacherous thoughts crept in. The new boy appeared one morning. He had messy hair, hazel eyes so bright they almost seemed to glow, and a dazed look. Thomas was pleased. Obviously someone had realised he was getting on, needed help. "Right then," he said. The boy only looked puzzled. Thomas raised his voice. "Over here." He showed him the cloths, polish, wrenches, all neatly laid out. He took pride in his tools. The boy nodded, but didn't actually do anything until Thomas put the cloth in his hand, showed him a smudge, and set him at it. Another bed had, of course, been provided, but the constant presence of another being took some getting used to. And the boy... his name was James. The boy was sloppy. Thomas caught him more than once sitting on his bed, staring at the walls, running his hands through his messy hair, when he should have been working. And he asked questions. "Where does this pipe go? What does this dial mean?" Thomas didn't know and didn't like these questions. They weren't respectful. The machine, however, seemed to like the boy's presence. It roared louder. The windows into its raging heart glowed hotter. It thudded and steamed with enthusiasm, and it grew faster. Whole new sections appeared overnight. James quieted, eventually. His hair settled down. He started to comb it neatly. The light in his eyes dimmed to something more appropriate. He stopped asking so many questions. Thomas was pleased to note the way James began to copy his own methods, the way he laid out his tools, the way he folded his cloths. Sometimes he heard the boy scream in the middle of the night, but he would settle down. Thomas had, after all. Thomas felt himself slowing. Not only his back, but his hands ached. His knees weren't up to the ladder anymore, and though he didn't quite yet trust James to do it properly, he had to let him do the climbing. One morning, Thomas was carefully polishing the face of one of the big dials, the one with a needle as long as his forearm. The dial was glossy with health. Thomas's hand looked ancient, the knuckles swollen, blue veins standing out under fragile skin. He looked up to see James swarming down the ladder with dangerous speed. Thomas felt his heart speed up. "What is it?" he shouted. "Is something wrong?" He imagined a leak, a break, steam from a joint, water dripping, rust, decay. James shook his head and pulled Thomas towards the bathroom cubicle. Thomas went, protesting, his polishing cloth still touched in his hand. James shut the door and leaned against it. His hair was on end again, his eyes furiously bright. He beckoned Thomas close. "What is this nonsense?" Thomas said, carefully folding his cloth. James beckoned harder. Thomas, sighing, went closer. James whispered, "There's a window up in the roof. I reckon we could get out." Thomas gaped. There was a strange feeling in his chest, pain like something cracking open. He pushed past James without a word and went back to his polishing, concentrating on the face of the dial, on its mysterious numbers. What did they mean? It wasn't his business to ask. He went on polishing until his arm hurt, until the dial gleamed like teeth. James pulled at his sleeve, shouted, but Thomas ignored him. The machine got louder. All around them there were roars and thuds and gushes of steam. James pulled at him one last time and then ran for the ladder. The floor shook. Up in the roof, things clanged. Thomas kept polishing. In the corner of his eye, James's thin legs were scrabbling higher. Higher. He kept polishing. The dial glowed for a moment with a strange new light that stung Thomas's eyes, a light from outside, an errant beam finding its way all the way down to the depths of the machine. Then the light was gone. Thomas kept polishing. His tears soaked his collar, but he ignored them. They'd send someone else, eventually. Just a note on that last one. That was written while I still had the day job.
Well, thank you very much, Gay. We'll take another brief break for glass refilling and stuff and reconvene for putting people to the question.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.